This hour, we'll be hearing excerpts from the Intelligence Squared U.S. debate on the proposition freedom of expression must include the license to offend. The live event took place at Asia Society in New York City on the evening of October 18, 2006, and was sponsored by the Rosenkranz Foundation. Speaking in favor of the motion were the Philadelphia Daily News editorial cartoonist Signe Wilkinson, editor of the Paris Review Philip Gurevich, and Atlantic Monthly essayist and author Christopher Hitchens. Speaking against the motion were Georgetown Law Professor Mari Matsuda, University of London History Professor David Cesarani, and the Executive Director of the American Society for Muslim Advancement, Daisy Kahn. As we do in each of these debates, the audience is polled before the event and again after the question and answer period. Prior to hearing arguments this time, the live audience voted 78% in favor of the motion, 11% against, 11% were undecided. The moderator for this event was Jeffrey Toobin of The New Yorker and CNN. Here he is to present the rules of the debate.
And welcome to the second Intelligence Squared U.S. debate. Let me give you a brief rundown of the evening. First, the proposer of the motion will start by presenting their side of the argument. The opposition will follow. Each person will get a maximum of 8 minutes and will go back and forth from one side to the other. Then, when all six speakers are finished with their opening remarks, I will open the floor to brief questions from the audience. Third, when the Q&A is complete, each debater will make a final statement lasting not more than 2 minutes each. Fourth, during the closing arguments, ballot boxes will be passed around for voting. Last, after the final closing statement is made, I will announce the results of the audience vote and tell you which side carried the day. So let's begin. Signe Wilkinson, you're first.
Thank you. And thank you, Jeffrey. Since World War III almost started over a bunch of cartoons, I want to thank this evening's organizers for including a cartoonist. 150 years ago, the Tammany Hall politician Boss Tweed responded to an offensive cartoon against him with the famous line, "Stop them damn pictures." The reason we're here tonight is that these days everyone wants to stop them damn pictures if the damn pictures in question hurt their feelings or the feelings of their tribe. What really enraged believers wasn't that Muhammad was pictured, but that he was pictured negatively. To test the point, at the height of the controversy, I put Muhammad in this cartoon, the Big Fat Book of Offensive Religious Cartoons. He's third from the right, flanked by Jesus and God and a few other laughing deities. No one protested this because no one cared about Muhammad being drawn as jolly and benign. When Hustler ran a spoof claiming that Jerry Falwell's first sexual encounter was with his mother in an outhouse, the Right Reverend Falwell did the Christian thing and sued in a case that went to the Supreme Court in 1987. The unanimous decision was written by that famed pinko degenerate William Rehnquist, who wrote that even though the spoof was outrageous, outrageousness in the area of political and social discourse is inherently subjective, and that the court has long protected free speech, even speech that offends the audience. So the offended are left with the same option I use, free speech. They can and do write, call, picket, boycott, and draw their own cartoons, but in America, thank God and the Constitution, they can't claim special privileges and stop them damn pictures. Thank you.
Mari Matsuda opened the arguments against the proposition.
It's really not fair to put me after the cartoonist, but I volunteered to go first. I'm sorry, I didn't bring cartoons, and I'm not going to make you laugh. I stand before you a censored person. Under American law, there are several things that I could not say. I could not attempt to sell you snake oil as a cure for cancer. I couldn't tell you secrets that I know that could make you millions of dollars when the stock market opens tomorrow. I couldn't tell a lie that would harm the reputation of any of the people on this stage. And I could not yell fire in a believable way that would cause a stampede for the exits. This point is the lawyer's point. In a complex society, law necessarily mediates between competing interests. Speech is one of those interests, and it is profoundly valuable. But when speech comes up against other interests that are also valuable, we have no choice. We mediate, we draw lines, we balance. This is what we do. When hate speech and propaganda instill beliefs of inherent inferiority, the very things that the First Amendment is intended to protect are at risk. When racist invective keeps you away from a public hearing, as has happened, when sexual taunting keeps you away from a job, as has happened, democracy's prerequisites of mutual exchange and participation are gone. Right after the major San Francisco earthquake, the last big earthquake, the big one, there was a public debate about whether to rebuild certain sections of the freeway, and one off-ramp in particular that led into Chinatown was of concern to the residents of that community, and they turned out for a public hearing. Well, the white Aryan resistance also decided to do a show of force at that hearing. Well, many of the elders in that community, the merchants who had come out to testify, it was their first experience with participation in the democratic process, and they were frightened away and were very unlikely to come out again as the debate continued around this issue of political discourse. If you think about why we disallow defamation or we impose legal penalties for it, it's because reputation is part of the self, and it's part of the self that's needed to participate equally in the democratic conversation. Your reputation is valuable, and thus we will restrain speech when it takes your reputation from you. I've asked for 30 years why we penalize someone who calls a doctor a quack, but we won't penalize someone who says that by race, the doctor is inherently worthless and properly subject to extermination. I haven't received an answer. If you believe, as I do, that unbridled freedom to wound with words and to incite through propaganda can harm the very freedom that we intend to protect by protecting speech, then I suggest that you vote against the proposition. The other side will tell you we can't start down that path of deciding which speech is acceptable, or we become trapped in the censorship business. This is a rhetorical move that lawyers call the slippery slope. What the other side will not tell you is that we are already on the slippery slope of tolerating censorship of certain forms of speech, including libel, fraud, copyright infringement, conversations in restraint of trade. There is no easy and absolute way out. We do have to decide when, where, and how we will limit speech.
Next, Philip Gurevich spoke in favor of the motion, freedom of expression must include the license to offend.
Side, let me begin with a monstrous image. In northern Uganda, for the last 15, 20 years, there has been a movement known as the Lord's Resistance Army. It practices its warfare in the name of God, and what it does when it dislikes the speech that is being made is that it cuts off the lips of the citizens who are speaking, and it puts padlocks through punctured holes in their lips and shuts them. I'm afraid that I'm very much unable to picture these people doing that, but it's very clear to me that that is what they wish to do. I will return to this image at the end, but that is the image that clearly you must bear in mind as you, the jury tonight, vote on the question of whether we shall be permitted to speak or whether we shall be inclined to silence anybody with whom we find offense, in whom we find offense. And that is what they're saying. Who are they to judge what is offensive? But one point of agreement that we have is that speech is fiercely powerful and can be intensely dangerous. I spent some time reporting from Rwanda in the aftermath of the genocide there, and one of the most striking things is that in the course of this genocide, a great deal of the genocide was incited by public speech, by radio speech, by incitement through words. And the words were used as hate speech, which you will find that the other side thinks should be censored because it is dangerous. The hate speech said, invariably, kill the minority, the Tutsis. They didn't always say it directly. They used euphemisms. The euphemisms would be phrases like, do your work, clear the bush, do not let a weed escape the blade. These were phrases that were well understood in the historical context, and they were clearly hate speech. There's no ambiguity about it. Those people have been tried and convicted for inciting mass murder in their country. The problem there was not free speech for haters. It was that this was the officially sanctioned speech by people who prohibited sanity from being free speech. Anybody who protested against the genocide was silenced as offensive. Offensive speech, my goodness, that Hutus and Tutsis should live side by side in comity, that they should allow each other to exist. How offensive. Let's silence them. Let's murder them. Let us have official speech. That was the position. And that is the position which, yes, ma'am, slippery slope. It's not a slippery slope. It's a greased precipice off which they wish to push you. Because once you start to say that racist speech or blasphemous speech is somehow or other offensive, you're immediately on the quick descent towards book burning. And the books that you wish to burn are the books that include, let's say, Huck Finn, where racist words are used in possibly the 19th century's most noble portrait of a black man in America. The question before us tonight, simply put and simply stated in the proposition that we were given, is that freedom of speech must include a license to offend. I would expand that license to blaspheme, and I would not call it a license. They speak of it as a license. They think all speech is a license, that all speech should be licensed because most speech should be restricted before it is licensed. And then we decide, okay, we'll let this out, we'll let that out, we'll let this out, we'll let that out. I think that that's a very, very, very dangerous precipice on which they want to perch us. I remind you one last time, as you go to vote, if you believe in chopping off lips and clamping on padlocks on open mouths, there's your troika.
I'm Robert Siegel. This is Intelligence Squared US, and we'll hear more of this debate on freedom of expression in just a minute. We now continue with Intelligence Squared US. The next speaker in this debate is David Cesarani, speaking against the motion, freedom of expression must include the license to offend.
I don't think it's really necessary to bother to respond to the very foolish idea of what this side of the House is advocating. We are not advocating cutting off people's lips. We're not even advocating repealing the First Amendment. We're not even advocating special laws that will have people banged up in prison for saying things that we don't like. We're just asking you, and I'm asking this as a foreigner, as someone who is British, to just reflect with a little humility on American society and culture, and reflect while holding in mind the fact that in most other liberal democracies, there are modest constraints on what can be said and written, and for good reason too. And most international conventions that set out freedoms also include constraints on the freedom of expression, most notably the European Convention on Human Rights. And the reason is that the European Convention on Human Rights that was passed in 1950 was framed against the background of genocide, mass murder, persecution, totalitarianism in Europe. When men and women had seen the effect, the drip-drip effect of hate speech, words that demeaned, that degraded, and resolved that freedom of speech could no longer be considered an absolute right. It was a right. It was a fundamental element of liberty. But it was not absolutely overriding because it was open to abuse. It was abused in Europe. It's abused now. Now, get real. You have constraints on freedom of expression in this great country. And what we are asking you to do is reflect with a little bit of humility of how you want those constraints to be exercised by the most powerful, the most ruthless, the ones with the biggest bank balances, the ones with the most votes, or do you want to have a public debate about how you protect those who are weak, who are vulnerable, who are defenseless, and who are marginal, and who are often abused in the mass media or in work settings?
Christopher Hitchens was the final speaker in favor of the proposition.
I might have a bit more for you. The real question, utterly, utterly dodged by David in his shady remarks, is this. Who will be the one who says, I know exactly where the limit should be, I know how far you can go, and I know when you've gone too far, and I'll decide that. Who do you know? Who have you heard of? Who have you read about in history who you'd give that job? I would say, just for this evening, I wouldn't give it to anyone who's spoken so far on the other side. There have been some bad signs lately. The imprisonment of David Irving in Austria for a thought crime, for the possibility that he might, while in Austria, have given a speech saying that he doubts some of the verdicts of history, as I consider them to be, about the final solution. And there's no victim to this crime. The Austrian consul called me up weeping with self-pity when I pointed this out in the Wall Street Journal, said, but we thought finally Austria would be popular. We had done something that you would all like. So gemütlich, the land that survives on the myth that Hitler was German and Beethoven was Viennese. The land that had Waldheim as its chancellor and has Jörg Haider as a member of its government can revenge itself on a defenseless British academic and jail him. This is a standing disgrace. And there are attempts to extend similar thought crime laws to other topics of historical importance, the most depressing of which recently is the decision, provisionally at any rate, by the French Parliament to criminalize discussion of the Armenian massacres, considered by me and most others to have been a planned genocide in the early part of the 20th century. Now you can't take the contrary view. I stipulate that all of these things, when they happen, offend me very much. I'm offended by them, I want you to understand. It goes to the core of what I do and what I am. The First Amendment doesn't just provide me with a living. The First Amendment is my life. When it's infringed, I am offended. I had claimed the right to be offended. Do not claim the right to go and burn down someone else's place of worship, to threaten their editor with violent reprisal, to picket their home, to publish their name in threatening terms on the internet. I won't do any of that. It doesn't mean I can't be offended, but it does mean that I'm even more offended by those who claim the right not just to be offended, but to seek violent reprisal, as is so vividly currently being done by the votaries of the Prophet Muhammad, in recent instances of which I only have no time at all to inform you, but about which you already know and to which I hope I will be asked to return. Thanks very much.
That was Christopher Hitchens for the proposition. Against the proposition now, Daisy Kahn.
Distinguished guests, Philip, Signe, and Christopher. First of all, I think it was divine intervention that Christopher was not allowed to continue. I think Christopher should nominate me to decide who will decide, because really, Christopher, I'm quite fair. And I definitely do not believe in cutting off lips, and I hate padlocks. So I want to begin by saying that the motion of today, whether freedom of expression must include the license to offend, is in a sense really a moot point. It's a moot question, and I hope that all of you here today will consider rejecting it, throwing it out. The freedom we have to express ourselves does, in fact, enable us to offend. Christopher is doing it all the time in his own sweet way. In fact, one can even say that sometimes it is necessary to offend, and for good cause. The appropriate question to ask today is whether freedom of expression is absolute and limitless, or should it come with some social responsibility? The reason why we're having this debate today is because a number of recent events, such as the Danish cartoon and the Pope Benedict's remarks on Islam, have brought this issue to the forefront. My Jewish friend called me right after the cartoon crisis. Jewish rabbi friend called me, said, "What are you doing about the cartoons?" I said, "What are we going to do? It's just a cartoon." He says, "No, don't ever accept it. This is what they did to us in Germany. Okay. They started with the cartoons."
Excuse me.
Wait, come on, come on.
I don't know, it's offensive.
Well,
and stupid.
Come on.
And nasty.
Christopher, Christopher, right. Come on.
Stupid, nasty.
Christopher, come on. Daisy, this will not be deducted from your time.
So when you publish cartoons, which of course are a form of entertainment and hence immensely popular as a medium for conveying a particular message, or you give a speech, a person in a position of immense power like the Pope, which further drives people apart and cements stereotypes, you're using public discourse to malign the way an already marginalized community is perceived. And this, my friends, is not in accordance with our foundational values of free speech. This is un-American. The point is not whether...
These are excerpts from a live debate, which you can hear in its entirety on our website, npr.org/intelligencesquared. In the audience question and answer period, David Cesarani continued on the theme Daisy Kahn had introduced with the Danish cartoon controversy.
David. A lot of the Jewish communities in Europe, including the Jewish community in Britain, and these views are articulated by the chief rabbi, Jonathan Sacks, felt that the cartoons were not only offensive, they were dangerous for the reasons that Daisy gave, and yes, because to many Jewish people, that kind of demonization of a religion and a religious ethnic group brought back some very sick and bad memories. And that is why in Europe, there is a much greater tolerance of what this side of the house is advocating than on that side, which is displaying an extraordinary degree not only of disrespect but also of arrogance and an astonishing unwillingness to face a real past.
I'm highly interested in facing a real past, and that's particularly why I feel that if your belief is that by muzzling Nazis you're making us safe, I hope you're not watching my back when they come back at us. I'm telling you the truth. If you think that there's a mute button and that by saying, oh, Nazis can't speak in public, Nazis must be put in jail, we're going to eradicate Nazism rather than by having Nazis in a country where you can actually speak to them and argue with them and not dignify them by putting them on trial every time they say something completely idiotic. You're elevating Nazis and putting them down and then inciting a couple of politicians in Europe.
It doesn't dignify them. David Irving's battle against Deborah Lipstadt exposed him for what he was. It was very effective.
He exposed himself for what he was. He said the Holocaust didn't exist, and it did. If you were to eradicate all false history, you'd have to stop all newspapers. It's ridiculous.
I beg your pardon.
Faced by a prison sentence, David Irving courageously renounced all that he's previously said about denying the Holocaust. The trial was very effective. Now, I don't actually agree with putting people in prison for advocating Nazi propaganda and a version of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, because that's what David Irving does. It's not a kind of genteel rewriting of history, which Christopher seems to think. It is the most poisonous kind of conspiracy theory.
How do I seem to think that?
Well, it's what you said in your article.
To
the
contrary.
And
what you
said just earlier, that he is engaged in the revision of history. He's not. He's a neo-Nazi propagandist. And this is what Justice Gray said in the verdict in his battle with Deborah Lipstadt. He is a neo-Nazi political activist, and he is using distorted history to propagandize for his cause.
And nobody had much heard of him until you put him on trial.
Well, you can fill it. You're a journalist. You're supposed to know these facts. He's a best-selling author. He's a very important guy. He gets into people's living rooms. And not for a while, though, because he's in a prison cell.
Nazis always get in the living rooms.
No, and his book, his edition of the Goebbels Diary, is a very useful and interesting book that everyone who wants to know more about the period should read. It's only in that book that it's proved that the British Union of Fascists took money from the Nazi Party, a claim they always denied. Do you think you're big enough to read a book by David Irving and make up your own mind about it, or do you think that someone else should do that for me, right?
Next question.
Very simple question.
Okay, well, let's take another question. We'll get to you next, Paul.
Okay, my question is the following. There was a cartoon in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago, which was never talked about. They always do a synopsis of cartoons that they think are particularly relevant.
Right, we know.
Deadly. Just
and so it was the Pope saying, "I'm sorry that my remarks about Islamic violence provoked Islamic violence." Now, nobody made a big scene about that, but who made the big scene about the Danish cartoon? Who got it started? It was an Islamic cleric who got everybody
in an uproar. What's your question?
So my question is, why does this happen only in this situation when it was outside of the United States, and why did it not happen here?
Okay.
Daisy, do you have a... I mean, I think that was mostly addressed to you.
Yeah. Well, I think what happened...
Daisy Kahn.
Thank you. What happened with the Danish cartoon was when the cartoon was published, there was a small little, demonstration by certain Muslim groups, and that was the newspaper decided that they were not going to pay any attention to that because they had a license to free speech, which was fine, freedom of expression. And then they took it up to some of the ambassadors of Muslim countries, and they were hoping that their intervention might have helped. The ambassadors called for a meeting with the prime minister, and that meeting was refused. And basically, the community felt that their hurts and their concerns were not being addressed. Mm-hmm. And they went overseas, and they sought support from overseas, and then the whole situation went out of
control.
Right.
So wait. And they torched the embassies.
Let Christopher respond.
I just want to finish the point. What I'm saying is that had it been addressed at the local level, it would have never become an international phenomena that it became. It should be addressed at the local level, like Signe did. When the Philadelphia Inquirer decided to publish that same cartoon, they called the Muslim community and said, "We want to do something about this and we want to create dialogue." Now, that was responsible. That was socially responsible.
Christopher, go ahead.
When Dr. Samuel Johnson had finished his great lexicography, the first real English dictionary, he was visited by various delegations of people to congratulate him, including a delegation of London's respectable womanhood who came to his parlor in Fleet Street and said, "Doctor, we congratulate you on your decision to exclude all indecent words from your dictionary." And he said, "Ladies, I congratulate you on your persistence in looking them up." I think anyone who understands that story, which I'm pleased to see everybody obviously does, will see through the sinister piffle we were just treated to just now. If people are determined to be offended, if they will climb up on the ladder, balancing it precariously on their own toilet cistern, to be upset by what they see through the neighbor's bathroom window, there's nothing you can do about that. The imams in Denmark did the following. First, they invited the intervention of 22 foreign ambassadors in Denmark's internal affairs. Itself a disgrace, the Danish Prime Minister quite rightly repudiated it. Then they added two cartoons of their own, drawn by them, one of them showing the Prophet Muhammad in the shape of a pig. Then they shopped those around the Muslim world until they could get kindling going under the embassies of a small democracy in the capital cities of countries where demonstrations are normally not allowed. And they violated Danish diplomatic immunity. They tried to sabotage the Danish economy. There were random pogroms and attacks on individual Scandinavians. And David Cesarini says he doesn't like the reminiscence of the 1930s that is inscribed in the cartoon. I don't like the reminiscence of the 1930s that is involved in a Kristallnacht against Denmark put up by religious demagogues and thugs. And that's what needs to be condemned.
David Cesarini.
I actually agree with much of what Christopher has just said. I think the response in the Muslim communities and in Muslim countries and in countries with large Muslim populations was abysmal. But I will absolutely defend the right of Muslims to protest in peaceful ways against those cartoons and to lobby.
Well, so would I.
So would all of us.
Good.
So would
we all, big boy. Okay, there's a measure of agreement. Now, let's think about this town. New York. Who are these marginal, vulnerable groups? It's kind of interesting that a lot of people, certainly on that side, have decided, well, yeah, Muslims, they're not vulnerable, marginal. They don't need protection. And if you exclude them, you know, who's left? Gay men? Women? Probably not. Jews? Definitely not. But how do we get to that position where gays, Jews in this town are now so strong, so powerful, so invulnerable? So much so that when Jesse Jackson had the temerity and the misfortune to refer to this great city as Heine Town, it was the end of his political career. I don't know how Christopher Hitchens or Philip or Signe want to talk about gay men and women, but I guess there are quite a few epithets and words they would not use to describe their lifestyle or sexual preferences. And then there's the N-word. The N-word. Do you want it back, Christopher? Do you want it on primetime TV, front page of the newspapers?
I don't want you jailing people.
Do you want it back? Do you want cartoons of lynchings?
Well, allow me to
answer. Is that what you want?
What kind of a fool question
is it? All right to inflict that on Muslims, but not on gay men, not on Jews, not on your kind of little club of vested interests that you want to protect?
You're getting yourself all in a twist.
Philip, go ahead, answer.
Allow me to say that you're creating a lot of fantasies for yourself that are quite ridiculous.
It's another
no. Let Philip.
I take it as a
first of all.
Wait, it's my turn.
My appointed speaker.
I'm going to take it as a tribute to the superior...
Are you muzzling me?
No. I'm going to take it as a tribute to the superior cogency of our side that there's this repeated change of subject from the other side. For example...
No, it's not the...
Nobody says it would be a good thing if the word nigger appeared all the time in the press. All we say is that those who want to be offended don't have the right to try and close down the newspapers that offend them.
Nor, by the way, is the reason that the word nigger doesn't appear in the press because we would jail people who put it there.
I appeal to anyone in this audience.
The advertisers wouldn't show.
One at a time.
This is Intelligence Squared US, and while the speakers debate whether freedom of expression must include the license to offend, we'll take a short break. I'm Robert Siegel, host of Intelligence Squared US. The moderator for this event was Jeffrey Toobin of The New Yorker and CNN. Let's continue now with excerpts of the question and answer portion of the debate.
You know, when it comes to the really tricky, sticky issues, like a discussion like we see around children and paedophilia, or as we see on the campuses where we see like speech etiquette, or when we see in the workplace speeches of code, would they agree with for the prospect that you should have the right to be offensive and free speech at all times? That's my question to them.
Mari, can you address that?
The line that I draw is between the right to dissent, to express your opinion. If you're Galileo, to oppose the powers that be and say that the sun is the center of the universe, that's free speech. That's what we need for democracy to thrive. The speech that I think is of lower value and that I'm asking us to consider restricting is speech that assaults, wounds, degrades, and excludes. Let me give you a specific example since you raised the workplace. It's a frequent pattern that the first woman to show up in a traditionally male job, in the coal mine on the oil rig, is relentlessly harassed with words. Men describing her body and saying they would like to rape her and describing what that would be like. And she goes to work every day and tries to do her job up on a construction site. I think that goes beyond offense. I think that is an effort to exclude. And people use these words because they're tied to a history of violence, because they do terrorize people. That is their intent. Now, the other side is trying to say that we're for opening the door of censorship. I certainly don't stand for that. I think that this audience voted in the vast majority for the proposition precisely because they distrust censorship, and that's good. That's important. Any effort to limit speech has to be done carefully through the rule of law with discernment, but we can do it. We've done that with defamation. We allow people to insult each other, but we don't allow them to destroy character and reputation in ways that the law calls actual malice. It's very close to requiring intent. And that's a limit. That means a lot of very nasty speech is still allowed. But we're trying to create that breathing space so that woman can go to work, so that family that's the wrong race can move into that neighborhood, where we can have conversations like this one that are very hard. If it degenerates into name-calling, the conversation shuts down. And what I'm trying to do is prevent the conversation ending move in a world in which we need to talk.
This is Intelligence Squared U.S. You're listening to excerpts of this live debate. You can find the unedited audio of the event at our website, npr.org/intelligencesquared. Our next questioner directly addressed points raised by Georgetown Law Professor Mari Matsuda.
Go ahead.
Okay, this is a question for Marie, and you talked about women in the workforce, and I don't work on an oil rig, but I do work on a trading floor. And I'm just wondering if you think that by limiting what people can say to me, if that's actually protecting me from what people are thinking about me, and whether when I come into the office, I need to take care of myself.
Good.
Marie?
And I trust that you can. But there are circumstances in which women have left jobs because they could not handle the relentless and brutal assaults on their personhood. And this is why in civil rights law, to respond to the earlier question.
Not a free expression question.
The reason in civil rights law and anti-discrimination law we do limit speech in the workplace is that ideas about your inferiority, about your inherent lack of worth as a human being and your lack of entitlement to equality in the workplace, if they're expressed regularly to you, create an environment in which it's impossible for you to do your job on an equal basis with everyone else.
Does someone on this side want to address Mari's point, which she's made, which is that there is, you know, this kind of speech, harassment? I mean, is that speech you seek to protect?
I get that kind of speech all the time. One of my favorites was being called a liberal but I didn't call the police on it. And furthermore, half the people who write me horrible, horrible things, no one has seen my mail, they all start at "Dear Mr. Wilkinson." So it's not as me as a woman, it's me, it's the ideas I put in the paper. And if we can't discuss those ideas, even when they talk to me in loathsome, funny ways, we can't talk. And the one thing I would like to say about the whole Danish cartoonist thing is that having had that confrontation has changed minds on both sides. The BBC reported that about 2 weeks ago there was another minor dust-up about it, but the reason you didn't hear about it is because the Muslim side realized that it really wasn't great PR to kill people in Pakistan to protest cartoons in Denmark. So it's a much different protest. It's been handled differently on both sides, including the Danish side. This is how we learn. We learn by conflict. We learn by calling each other things that, well, maybe weren't a great idea at the time, but we can do it differently next time.
To conclude, each speaker gave a 2-minute rebuttal. We begin with Mari Matsuda speaking against the proposition, freedom of expression must include the license to offend.
The N-word is hollered out from a passing car to let a black man know that he is not walking in a neighborhood where he is welcome or safe. The speaker knows the effect of that word and uses it precisely because it terrorizes. Why is it that we recognize in American law that if someone spits on your shoe, that's an attack on your personhood, but we won't recognize words that we know socially, historically, from the reality of the human lives that we live, have exactly the same effect on your personhood and your ability to move freely. I am talking about liberty, and it's fascinating that we are all coming from the Enlightenment tradition.
1 minute.
And as much as we disagree, I feel affinity with people on the opposing side because we are all concerned with losing our democracy and losing our freedom. I think there are forms of speech that make us less free because we stop talking to each other and we don't have the conversations we need to survive. And allowing this kind of invective perpetuated, Daisy has been out on a limb on herself defending the Muslim community, and I have to speak up. There is hatred of Islam in this country, and it's not a healthy thing. There's also ignorance. And we need to open a space where we can talk to each other, disagree, criticize, and learn. And that space closes when people are allowed to assault. I'm not asking for censorship. I'm asking that if you support the proposition, you're making a choice for a license to assault.
Daisy,
if you oppose it, you open the door for a conversation about limits.
Okay, next. Thank you. That was Mari Matsuda. Now, for the proposition, Signe Wilkinson.
Well, I basically said earlier pretty much what I think here, but this is a conversation. If you forbid someone to say what's truly on their mind, you won't know what is on their mind. And it's better, almost every time it seems to me, to find out what it is and then be able to deal with it. I think some of the questions get back to what is truly hateful speech, and our history is filled with, for example, horrible images of black Americans who were made fun of simply because they were black. And these images occurred everywhere, in Courier and Ives and all of the major publications in the United States. But the way that changed was not by someone saying, you may not ever do a bad caricature of a black person. It was changed because the civil rights movement and black Americans showed through their own incredible endurance and persistence in going for equal rights in this country, that movement made those images look awful. You can't look at them today without wincing. So I feel sorry for you in New York because you don't have very many really bitter cartoons published here. The New York Times protects you from that. But I really urge you to go on the web, find out what people are thinking, and you'll find out through cartoons, among other pieces of free speech.
Thank you. Thank you, Signe Wilkinson. Against, David Cesarani.
Yeah, I think what Signe said then about the struggle of black Americans to eradicate racist images from public media was very interesting and very important. Dignity, equality, and civility are values. They are goods. Freedom of expression is a value, and it is a good. On this side, we're simply been asking you to weigh up those values, those goods. We think that human dignity, equal treatment, and having a truly civil society is worth a modest, preferably voluntary degree of constraint, restraint, a showing of humility, knowing where to draw the line. Thank you.
Thank you. David Cesarani. Now, for the proposition, Philip Gurevich.
The proposition is
freedom of expression must include the license to offend. I would return to the idea that this is fundamentally the lesser of various not ideal prospects. The other prospect is that one licenses someone to determine what offends, and that one is always at the prey of that question. Who is to judge? Who is to decide? How are we to restrict their ability to license our ability to offend? In other words, how are we to restrict their ability to restrict us? And at what point does this admittedly slippery slope immediately become this greased precipice and we fall off into a very dangerous situation? The other side says speech is dangerous, speech can be hateful, there's hatred and ignorance out there, and therefore they want in some way to muzzle the people that they fear are dangerous. I agree with them that speech is dangerous and speech can be dangerous, and that there is a great deal of hatred and ignorance out there. We've heard a good deal of ignorance even tonight. And I feel that that is why I urge you strongly to listen to the dangerous speech you're hearing from the other side and recognize exactly how it can impinge upon your ability not only to speak but to think. The fact that they keep using this strangely castrated phrase, the N-word, which is supposed to be inoffensive, but is actually doubly offensive because it restricts you from the ability to hear the full offense of the word nigger. And they're at every time trying to double back and triple around and make you use words and trip over your own mind and not think and not speak what actually might occur to you in your effort to observe reality and contend with it. I think that's a very dangerous predicament. I think that they are presumptuous and wild in their notion that we can do that reasonably. And I think that we are at less risk taking the great risk of freedom.
Thank you, Philip Gurevich. Against the proposition, Daisy Kahn.
If all of us here wanted to offend each other, I'm sure we can, but would it be beneficial to building trust and building long-term relationships? I was stunned at the response I got about my rabbi friend. It is the deep dialogue that has been going on between me and the Jewish community that has resulted in that concern for our community. And it is out of that concern that the rabbi friend reached out to me and said, do not let this happen to you. We're living in a tense global environment where misunderstanding is increased by peddlers of fear and overpowered by intolerance. Today, what is needed is civility, tolerance, patience, and sincerity. We need to get rid of negative words like offend. It's a negative word. And replace them with positive words like befriend. Only once you make the effort to understand the perspective of the other person can you begin to understand the rationale behind the actions and thoughts. Furthermore, you'll be in a better position to influence them. And only then can you even begin to be critical. We humans have a nasty habit of judging the book by its cover. If you're offensive, it is difficult to make a difference because you are seen as hostile and your views are unwelcomed and outright rejected. This is human nature. On a personal road, the reason I'm here today and I've dedicated the rest of my life to furthering understanding between peoples has to do with my powerful memories of my childhood in Kashmir. I went to Catholic school, was taught by Irish nuns, learned math from Hindu professors, played with Sikhs and Buddhists, and was told the tale of how Kashmiris were from the lost 10th tribe of Israel. I was exposed to this broad perspective of unity and diversity where celebrating and honoring each other's traditions and beliefs was the way of life. But alas, this heaven turned into hell too.
Thank you, Daisy Kahn. Against the proposition. Finally, for the proposition, Christopher Hitchens.
The real question, or if you like, subtext question before us is this, is nothing sacred? What we've really been discussing is the old question of whether or not there is such an offense as blasphemy or profanity. Now, if I don't tell you exactly what I think about the simpering speeches that we heard from the other side, I'm not censoring myself. I'm just being polite and civil and saving some of your time. What I will not prevent myself from saying, will not let anyone else prevent me from saying, is the following. It is wrong, and always has been, for churches, powerful, secular, human institutions, to claim exemption from criticism, which is what's really being asked here. If there's going to be respect, it has to be mutual. Does Islam respect my right to unbelief? Of course it does not. Does it respect the right of a Muslim to apostatize and change belief? Of course it does not. I have had to have, I can name now four or five friends, six or eight maybe if I had time, five or six of whom you would certainly have heard of, who have to live their lives under police protection for commenting on Islam. for having an opinion on it. And this is getting steadily worse all the time. And it's grotesque. Here is an enormous religion with gigantic power that claims that an archangel spoke to an illiterate peasant and brought him a final revelation that supersedes all others. It's a plagiarism by an epileptic of the worst bits of Judaism and Christianity. That's obvious, it seems to me. How long do you think I'm going to be able to say that anywhere I like? It would already be quite a risky thing to say in quite a lot of places. I did not come to the United States of America 25 years ago to learn how to keep my mouth shut. And I'm going to reject, all offers that I changed that policy, however simperingly they are put, okay?
Please join me in thanking the debaters for a terrific work. But now it's time for me to announce the results. As you recall, just to refresh your memory, before the debate, the result was 177 for the proposition, 25 against, and 24 don't know. Now the result is 201 for the proposition, 39 against, one doesn't know. So please congratulate the four team for winning the debate.
And that concludes our debate. Thank you for listening. You can also learn more about the Intelligence Squared debate series, get a schedule of the Intelligence Squared events, and listen to the full unedited audio from this debate at our website, npr.org/IntelligenceSquared. The Intelligence Squared U.S. debate series is an initiative of the Rosenkranz Foundation, Chairman Robert Rosenkranz, Executive Producer Dana Wolf. For more information about this series, or to find out how you can get tickets to attend this live event, visit www.iq2us.org. That's www.iq2us.org. The goal of Intelligence Squared US is to raise the level of public discourse in American life and to recognize that on most contentious issues, both sides have intellectually respectable views. This series is produced for radio by WNYC New York Public Radio. Producer Rob Christensen, senior producer Ellen Horn. The recording was engineered by Edward Haber and Damon Whittemore. Intelligence Squared US is distributed by NPR, National Public Radio.